ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last. It is my pleasure to be with you once again for this, which is a somewhat different episode of the Studcast. Let me explain a couple things right now here. We were getting ready to record episode 87. We were closing in on our scheduled recording time, and we got news. Ron's mother, who is 91 years old, had a fall. So Ron is right now with her, taking care of things, looking after things. And because of that, we had to postpone this week's episode of the Studcast. And we apologize profusely, and I'm sure on behalf of myself and all the listeners, we send our best wishes to Ron's mother and hope for a speedy recovery. But what we're going to do here this week is we're going to air some clips that have never aired on the regular Studcast, only on the Super Studcast and the rest of the story. Of course, if you enjoy what we do on the Studcast, we encourage you to become patrons of the Studcast for only $2.99 at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. And like I said before, we're going to play a couple clips so you have an idea of the kind of shows that we're doing for patrons of the Studcast. And for this first clip, let's hear a little bit of Robert Fuller, the brother of the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, when he was on the show. So we had two different variations of the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller and Robert Fuller. Let's listen to a little bit of this conversation from the Super Studcast right now. Which one of you was stiffer in the ring?
Oh, my Lord, is that an easy one? Oh, good Lord. This guy used to walk up and down in the dressing room and pace. Wall-to-wall pace, and guys that were wrestling him would watch him, and they would look at me sometime, and they were like, "What is this?" I say, "It's a nut." I said, you got your friggin' hands really full tonight because he's nervous, and that's why he's pacing up and down like that. That he already has it in his mind that it's not going to be the greatest match of the night, and he's wanting to steal the show, and so he's pouncing up and down saying, "Gosh, dog, I hope this works. I hope that works. I hope this works." And the guy, his opponent, sitting over there going, "My goodness gracious, settle down, son." Said, I used to get a kick out of watching that, and I'd laugh about it.
See, I don't know if I can make a comment to it or not. You know, I'll tell you what.
Nothing's going
to
work.
If you talk around to guys in the business, though, I have a pretty nasty reputation as being a little stiff. I guess they call it stiff. In fact, my punches, they nicknamed my punch. They called it the wraparound. And anybody that I've ever hit with a punch can attest to the fact that it's not really easy to take. So I guess I have to take that I take that winner's prize, I suppose, as being stiff, or the loser's prize, whichever way you look at it.
I never had to work with Ron, but if I'd had to work with him, I think I probably would have blocked that.
It's a shame no one else ever thought of that.
Yeah, I think I'd have thrown up an arm. Or, you know, another idea that's good, too, is how about ducking?
There you go. Well, let's stay on the topic of your father, because he obviously came up in that he taught you guys the Fuller leg lock. But this next question here is from Fred Edelman. Not disparaging your dad or your grandfather's business practices, but it sounds like you both had different philosophies on taking care of the boys on payoffs. Could you comment on why there's a difference?
Well, it's, you know, I give you a big, long answer, and I will give you a big, long answer, but I'll start off with a short one. You're either honest or dishonest. That's kind of the way I looked at it, that my dad and my grandpa were out to make all the money. My granddaddy had this saying, and he'd say, big bees, let me get it right here now. Little bees do the work, big bees make the money. Wrestler does the work, promoter makes the money. And that was when my grandpa used to say that all the time, that, hey, you better figure that one out pretty quick, because, you know, we're the ones that putting on the show, and you wouldn't even have a place to work if it wasn't for me. And that was always dad saying anyway, guys wouldn't even have a dollar in their pocket if it wasn't for me. I'm the guy that makes the show work. And so they had very little mercy for what you thought the payoff was. And if you argued about it too much, in a lot of cases, you wouldn't have your job next week. So you better keep your mouth shut. But we always thought that guys go out there, they give us their all. And I always thought personally that that these guys were my total success. Without them, I couldn't do anything as a booker, that I'd be a failure as a booker, that I needed these boys to give me 100% of everything they had every night. And I wanted, and I was prideful. I remember working for Jerry Jarrett the first time I'd met Jerry, and he'd made my payoff, and the payoff was extremely good, and way back in the early 70s, and he was so happy to give me that payoff, and I wanted to be the same way. When I worked with my guys, I looked forward to handing them their check, because I wanted to see the smile on their face, because I wanted them happy. And we meant to keep them that way. We weren't doing the Roy, Nick, or Dad type of thing that said, hey, the promoter takes all the money. Well, that's not the way we ran our business.
To just follow up on it, there's kind of a set figure, you know, in my mind anyway. A lot of promoters, I think it's 25%. You know, a lot of guys want to pay that. 25 was a pretty well standard around promoters. You paid north of that, more than that. You were doing right by your boys. You paid less than that, and you weren't doing right by your boys. And we always made our payoffs based upon a percentage, certainly above the 25%. And we had happy guys. We end up having some of the best talent in the country. A lot of young guys came through, started with us, that when I see them today, they say, geez, man, you guys always really took care of us great. And I really appreciate those comments, because we worked hard to do just that. We did not feel like that we were entitled to make a heck of a lot of money and the boys suffering at the same time. It's just not the way the business should be. And my dad and my granddad, probably to put it in perspective, my granddad grew up in New Mexico with no shoes on his feet and living in the prairie for 3 months one time as a 12-year-old boy. So, I mean, you know, they had it tough. And probably when they got started as promoters, they started looking at it and saying, geez, man, you know, I need to make up for how I grew up and how tough it was for me as a young guy.
And they were probably just following in the footsteps of all the other promoters all throughout the country that were shortcutting their guys.
Yes.
That they knew that if there's not one guy over here that's messing up the deal, we can all fudge a little bit on the payoffs, and there's no place for these guys to go that's any better than here. So,
good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the things you talked about on the Super Studcast, Rob, is that you're falling out. I shouldn't even say falling out, but your problem with Jerry Jarrett was you were trying to take care of your crew, and that wasn't going to happen. That wasn't going to happen, and your father even stepped in. It wasn't going to happen there. And we know, we talked about your crew, some of the guys, Toru Tanaka, Tony Charles, Do you think you were closer with the guys in your crew than most guys? I mean, Buddy Rogers had a crew he traveled around with, but it seemed like you had a real closeness with your guys.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were all like family. We're all like family. And if you ever came into my dressing room, you saw a lot of camaraderie, a lot of joking, a lot of carrying on. I was bad about it that I know when I was booking for Ron that several times Ron would look at me like, what in the heck is going on? Because Ron, a different type of guy. He'd sit in the dressing room before his match and he didn't like it. He didn't like to laugh. He was very serious. And if you told a joke or if you said something that was just off the cuff and you couldn't help but laugh and it made him snicker or made him laugh, he'd actually get mad at me about it. He was like, hey, we're here to do a dadgum job. We're not here to dadgum play, but I liked my dressing room to be romper room. And I like for all of my boys to have a good time and enjoy their work and keep it leisurable and at ease and everybody feel less pressure that guys, we're just going to come in here and do our job and we're all good at it and we're all going to do the best we can. And I got total faith in you.
You know, too, Brian, he had a term a minute ago, family. I mean, that's what we had with Southeastern, both Southeastern companies, Continental. We always had family. The dressing rooms were quite a bit different. If you've been in the wrestler, and a lot of wrestlers can tell you, you can go into some dressing rooms, St. Louis, and I can name a few cities in which, you know, you're very uncomfortable. Everybody in there is very uncomfortable. There's no camaraderie. In our dressing rooms, from all the times that we ran business, guys loved working there because they felt like they were part of a family, that they were being paid properly, and they were able to have a good time. They were able to come to work and not just come to work and it be a grind, come to work and have a good time while you're there. And leave with the pocket full of money. And it was we tried to keep that atmosphere. I think it was important for us. We were in small territories as compared to a lot of other territories, and we kept great talent because we had family. That's a family word, and that family situation was imperative to us. We wanted that atmosphere.
We talked about Memphis in 1979 when you left as booker. Let's go back to that period of time. Of course, this is 2 years after Jerry Jarrett splits off from Nick Goulas, and this question is from Russell Bell. On Channel 5 TV in Memphis, it would say Jarrett Welch Promotion. Was this your father? Was he the Welch they spoke of?
Yes. Yeah, that was Dad. That when Roy passed away, Dad inherited his part of that territory there, and that he and Jarrett became equal partners. And I think they had a couple of other partners, but anyway, they were equal in themselves. And yeah, Dad was the other person.
And going back to this period of time, let's go to our next question here, which relates to this as well. It's from Ephraim Goodman. What was the difference in how Nick Goulas ran a promotion versus Jerry Jarrett?
You know what? There wasn't a great deal of difference. I think possibly Jarrett, well, I won't say he paid more, but you made more money working for Jarrett because Nick ran Birmingham on Monday. Jarrett ran Memphis. Memphis was sometimes twice as good as Birmingham. On Tuesdays, Nick would run Florence, Alabama. And then if you worked for Jarrett, you'd go to Louisville, Kentucky. And so you were able to work in the garden there in the full house and make yourself $350, $400 payoff. You certainly weren't going to get that in Florence working for Nick. It was at Nashville for Nick on Wednesday nights. And then on Wednesday nights, you'd go to Evansville for Indiana for Jarrett. Jarrett just had a better end of the territory than Nick had. And so I don't know about their payoffs or how they handle their money. I think both of them is pretty skimpy, but Jarrett had a real quality end of his territory to work with. He had big buildings and large cities, and great TV. And you wanted to work for Jared if you worked in that territory. I worked for Nick an awful lot, and I loved old Nick. You know, I'm one of the few guys that did, but I looked at him also as kind of family because him and Roy had been together so long and had such a history. And Nick never bothered me, riling me up and saying, "Hey, boy, gosh, dog, we're going to get her going. I want to see you fire. I'm going to get some blood on you, and I want you to fight, and I want you to fire." And I sat there and listened to that, and I was one of these kids. I got pumped up by it. It worked for me.
Oddly enough, I only worked for Jerry Jarrett for about a year in 1974. I only worked for Nick two or three times in two or three towns. The difference in, to me, you know, and I'm gonna drop back to a Jack Briscoe story. Jack and I sitting in the dressing room in Florida one night, and we got to talking about Nick, and Jack went in to work for Nick in Nashville when he was young, and he didn't have the skills that they had when he was in Florida, and he was over, and he certainly didn't have the skills he had when he became champion. But we talked about Nick and Nick's payoffs, and I said, "What was your experience with Nick and his payoffs?" And Jack said, "Well, I'll tell you, Ron," he says, "I went into Nashville in a Cadillac, and I rode out on a Greyhound."
That's real. That's real.
And he wasn't the only guy that said those types of things to me. So I don't have the same opinion of Nick. This simply related to what I heard from other guys. And that's a pretty sad state of affairs. And you know, Jack might have gone in there in a Cadillac. And if he stayed there long enough, a lot of those guys that worked for Nick, they did go out in the Greyhound. They had no car anymore, and their lifestyle was pretty well decimated by whatever. And you know, you had to be one of Nick's boys, I think, to be able to really do well for Nick.
Yeah, and a new guy coming in, he had no respect whatsoever that Nick had paid him what he wanted to, treat him like he wanted to, and he would dare him to say a word about it because he'd say, "Where'd you come from, punk? You know, you're in the big times now, and you're going to do like I tell you and be happy about it." That's the way it was back then.
Well, you liked Nick, Rob. What did you think when everything went down in 77 when Jerry Jarrett split off and now he's running opposition in Memphis, and pretty quickly Nick's out of Memphis? What are you thinking when all that's going down?
Well, I had little differences with Jared on that because I'm one of these young fellas that I say, you know, guys like Nick, you may have your differences in the way you feel about him, his payoffs or whatever, but he had been around forever. And he was one of those old big time promoters you'd see in Las Vegas when Dad would take us there as kids that you know, you see him walking up and you just have respect for him because he's been around so long and been successful so long. And he and my grandfather were close. And I love seeing him. He was like Uncle Nick. And I probably, truth be known, I don't remember if I was around there at that particular time. I might have worked for Nick in order to get back at him a little bit. Jared had treated me well. I'd made a lot of money because we sold out a lot of houses. But I kind of had a little bit of a family feeling for Nick, and I think I probably would have backed him up.
Well, let's remember what Jerry Jarrett's story is, and let me put it on you, Rob, and see what you would do. You own a promotion. Okay. Let's say you have Memphis, and I tell you, I want you to push George Gulas to the top of the cards every week. I don't care. I don't want to hear it. You're going to make him the top babyface there. What do you do?
You know, they had more serious problems than that. I think if I was Jared, I would have said, "Listen, Nick, you got Birmingham and you got Nashville and you got Chattanooga and you got Huntsville and Florence and all these towns that you're running. How about he becomes the greatest star in those towns? That, you know, if you're, you know, and once he can sell out Birmingham, or once he can go and sell out Chattanooga on a Saturday night, Memorial Auditorium, then we'll talk about giving him a push here in Memphis. But I think I would have, I certainly would have had my differences had I been Jarrett, because any time that you got good business going and you got a good crew going, and it also seems like too that guys in the business had a problem with George. A lot of them had a problem with him. I didn't have a real big problem with him. I drove down the road about 100 miles an hour, and Nick would never have George ride with me or hang around me. He thought I was crazy. And so he liked me, and he thought I was all right. But he said, oh, that boy's too wild to be hanging out with George. He'll kill George. And so I never had to baby George much. But if I'd have had to, if I'd have been running a territory and been in Jarrett's situation and been had George just laid on me, that I think I would have had to get face to face with Nick and let him know that this is business and I'm selling out, and I might use George, but I will use him in the place that he deserves to be in, that he may be working my first match. And if he can work his way up to my third match, then God bless him. But I don't know about him ever being my main event. And I, you know, it should have been some way. Nick was a smart man, that you should have been able to get to him and say, hey, you know, we'll give this thing a go, but we're certainly not going to just bring George in and put him on top. It'd be ridiculous. It costs us a ton of money. And naturally, I'm not going to do that.
Who do you think wanted it more for George, George or Nick?
Both that, you know, Nick. Oh, he loved that boy. I mean, he really loved him. He had guys pick him up, take him to shows and he told them, you drive 60 miles an hour and you take George by the pizza parlor and make sure he gets a pizza. He likes to eat a pizza for his match and all of this stuff. And so that didn't do George any favors for sure.
No.
That, you know, and guys that did it always bitched and griped about it. And so the other guys in the crew would say, hey, better never call me and tell me to haul that punk around. So, you know, they just did that wrong. Nick should have, he probably should have let George at times get in his car and drive to the town on his own, like I did so many times. He should have not catered him around and pushed him so hard to force guys to try to like him. It was the same thing with Jarrett. To tell Jarrett you're going to bring him in there and put him on top, that automatically makes Jarrett hate George. You know, he says, oh, goodness. And it's not really George's fault, that a lot of that was Nick's fault. And that's why I don't criticize George a whole hell of a lot, because he was put in a really funny spot there and trying to come into wrestling. And, you know, but it's one of those things.
Back to the question about Jarrett Welch after the split with Gulas. What was the end of that partnership? How did your father's partnership with Jerry Jarrett end there?
They didn't get along. They didn't get along. That Jarrett... he was really on top of his business, and Dad was hit and miss. And Jarrett liked that, because he didn't want to have any argument. He didn't want anything. He wanted to do it the way that he wanted to do it. And I know Jerry's a real fine booker, and that he had everything figured out. And really, unless you're going to come in and see what he has and some way add to it, he really wouldn't want you there at all. And that Dad might have been criticizing this or that to say, maybe we could change this, change that. But when you spend all week long as a booker figuring out how you're going to do your TV on the weekend, you don't want a fella that's working 2 days a week, 3 days a week to come in and have much influence in it. That I can see Jarrett's situation and Dad was always too pretty close to a shooter, and he thought things should be wrestling. And Jarrett thought that, like Nick a little bit, that we got to go to war, and we have to go to war on our interviews to get the people to buy the ticket for the house, and then when they get there, we don't want to grab a headlock and we don't want to work a holt. We actually want to go to war, and we want some blood, and we want some action out here. And Nick was the same way. And it just, but Dad would, to me, Dad would drag you along there a little bit. But in, on the other hand, if you'd give Dad the 30-minute match, the 40-minute match, he would give you more product than Jarrett would. So it's just the way of doing things.
In my opinion, has a lot to do with they're two different generations. Jerry is 20, 25 years younger than Dad. Dad's day and time, things were done differently. And you can't really knock them in a way. For instance, Dad drew the 38,000 people in Atlanta and 40,000 in Mobile. And he did it with a totally different style of operation than what Jerry's running. He built his business on hard ways and on real wrestling, a lot of wrestling. And they went to war in a really war atmosphere. That picture that I have on one of my stud casts with my dad after that Atlanta match, and he's been hard weighed and he's got that foggy look in his eyes. He's had a concussion, and then, he's gone through hell in that match for those 38,000 people in that crowd. And I don't know that Jared ever drew 38,000 people in one crowd. So I don't know which is the better of the two, but their time frame is a generation apart, and so is their mindset about how to run their business.
It reminds me, when you bring up the Atlanta match, of Mario Galento. And Robert, I'd really love to know what your memories of Mario are.
It's scary. as a young fellow, I thought he was crazy. I knew that he was dangerous, and he was really, really tough. And hearing Dad talk about him and being around him, the little bit of time that I was, I was very leery of him. I was scared of him because, I thought that, he was capable of flying off the handle or doing anything or being unpredictable. And as a little boy, I didn't want to mess with any of that.
He was the type of guy, Brian, that Dad told me a story one time. He said, I asked him, I said, how do you take care of guys that are doing hard ways? And he said, well, he said, in Mobile back in the days, and this is the 50s, late 50s, he said, I would pay them $25 for a hard way. And I was like, wow, we're talking about the late 50s, 25 is more money, obviously, than it is nowadays. But he's, and then I said, well, how many hard ways did guys do? And he said, well, usually, he said, I would pay 25 for a hard way. And he said, Mario would collect 150 at the end of the week.
Wow.
He had to tell him to stop it.
He had to say no more. He had to say no more. He would hard way every night. Now that's, and then Dad told me a story one time about Mario, and he said, one night he got a hard way. He went to the hospital. He was in a hurry to get back home, and they got ready to shoot him with the Novocaine. And he says, no, I don't need it. Just sew it up.
Wow.
There's a dude, man, that you don't mess with.
On the Super Studcast, Ron has spoken with many of wrestling's legends, from Terry Funk and Stan Hansen to Kevin Sullivan and the Honky Tonk Man, and in this case that we just heard, his own brother, Robert Fuller, also known as Colonel Rob Parker, Tennessee Lee, and probably a few other names that I don't even know about. But we're going to play one more clip for you right now from the Super Studcast. This is a little bit of an example of the deep dives that we do, the historical looks that we do back on not just Ron's career, but on wrestling history in general. And for this one, we're going to look at Ron's one and only trip to Japan, teaming up with Barry Windham against Bruiser Brody and Stan Hansen. Let's go to this clip right now.
First match is that night. And guess who the first match is, obviously. It's going to be Brody and Hansen, and it's a TV match to make it worse. And So there's a real experience for us. We go down, Barry comes down in the lobby. We all meet in the lobby. We get into taxis, and it's Barry, my wife, and I in a taxi. And they put two or three guys in each taxi, and they took us to the arena. Well, our cab is toward the end of the parade of taxis, and he somehow gets separated, and he doesn't know where to go at the back of the building. So he takes us to the front of this big, huge building in Osaka. And we don't know anything about the building. We don't know nothing about the interior of the building. And there is probably, I'm going to estimate there's probably 10,000 people outside trying to get in. And he pulls right up to the front of the building and stops. And when he does, all these Japanese, there's no cabs there. We're the only car. They look in there and they see us wrestlers in there. Oh, and they start pointing, and then the crowd starts just mashing into our vehicle. And I'm screaming at the taxi guys, the taxi driver, you know, get out of here. We got to go. Hey, we can't, we're going to get killed here. And he can't speak English, so he doesn't know what we're saying. The car, this cab then is in, it's blocked. He can't back up. He can't go forward. So I tell my wife, I say, we're going to get out this door. I'm going to kick this back door open, and we're going to get out of this cab. You get on my back, and Barry, you get behind her. And I said, we're going right up those steps and into that building. We're going to find the dressing room. And so we do. And it's a struggle all the way. I mean, we're just being tugged and been slapped and pulled on. And we get to the building, inside the building, and I see at the far back side is Terry and Junior standing out by the dressing room. So it gives me a pinpoint, and we work our way to get in there. So we're just, by the time we get there, we're already exhausted. We've had to fight the crowd to get into the building. And then they say, get dressed pretty quickly. And they have great traditions in wrestling in Japan. And one of them is when the tour begins, everybody goes to the ring. So they ring the bell for the first time. Everybody goes out dressed in your gear. And they put these sashes across your body that tells your name. And then the fans throw these streamers in the air from all over the arena. The air is just full of streamers. They give you these big, huge bouquets of flowers. They introduce you one at a time. There's a great tradition to all that. It's like, wow, this is pretty cool, you know. And then you go back, and then you come out according to your match. Well, we were last, obviously. And we come out for our match. We go to the ring first. Brody and Hanson come out the back of the building, and we can see them as they come out of the dressing room. They start, Hanson comes out, he has his lariat, he has his rope with him, and he starts swinging his rope. What happens in Japan, it's like, it's totally different than any place in the world that I've ever seen. The fans, once the bell rings, they stampede to the dressing room. They want to be right there as close as they can get to you. And they actually want to touch you. It's kind of like a game's going on between the fans and the wrestlers, as to the wrestlers want to keep them back, and the fans want to get in there and just slap you, just get their hands on you, and then they run. So this mob of people starts toward the back of the building. Hanson comes out first. He's swinging his rope, and people are backing away a little bit. And then Brody comes out. He's got a chain. This chain is probably, I don't think it was 15 feet long, I would guess, and big, thick chain. And he's swinging it over his head at about the height of everybody's heads. And I'm like, God, me and Barry are watching it. We're talking to each other. And I go, gee, my knee, have you ever seen anything like that? And then all of a sudden, Brody's got the chain up high, and he just drops it down low, and he starts taking the feet out from underneath hundreds of them. I mean, bodies are starting, the backs of their heads are hitting the floor. They're leaving a path of bodies. all the way to the ring. And we watched that, and it's a big old building. It takes them a while to get there because there's such a mob of people. So they obliterate everybody all the way to the ring. And instead of coming up the aisle like you normally would, they go down to the middle of the ringside section, and they go right through the ringside. They start taking the chairs and throwing them into the crowd. It's like me and Barry are in the ring, and we're like, oh, my God. Have you ever seen anything like this? I mean, if you were in America, you're looking at a lot of lawsuits. I mean, you're out of business. Your first match, you're out of business. And then they get there, and then the real decimation begins. Working with those guys, it was just unbelievable. We just, Barry would, he would be in there, and he couldn't wait to tag me so that I could get in and get some of it myself. At one point in there, Brody gets a chair. And I'm expecting that I'm going to get it. I'm on the outside of the ring, and I see him grab the chair. So I bow up my back expecting that, you know, he's going to really lay it in there. Well, he hits me so hard with the chair that it sounds like a shotgun went off, like somebody got shot, you know, pow. It was like that kind of a noise. And it was like, it was so hard, it didn't hurt. I was expecting, gosh, that sounded unreal. It had to hurt, but it really didn't hurt me very bad. So later on, when we wrestle him the second time, I get my chance to get the chair shot back. I get myself a chair, and I work on Brody with it. But it's a fight the entire match. And as we're leaving the building, I'll never forget this. We get in the cab together, and we're going back. We're not going to take a shower. Barry is just, he's just like, he's huffing and puffing and like, oh my gosh almighty. He's like talking to himself. And we get in the cab, and he's in the front and we're in the back, my wife and I. And he says, he doesn't say anything for a while. And I said, what do you think, Barry? And he goes, you know, Ron, he says, my daddy never beat me like that. I thought it was the greatest line ever. I just cracked up, man. My first thought was right then, I thought, this is going to be one hell of a long tour.
What did your wife think? Where was your wife during the show, and what did she think compared to whatever wrestling she had seen in America?
She stayed back in the bleachers pretty close to the dressing room. And, I was obviously smart enough not to get in the aisleways and not to get down there where she could get hurt. But she was that night, we talked about it, and she was like, oh, my gosh. She goes, I've never seen anything like that in my life. She goes, same thing I just said. She goes, we'd be out of business if we had them come to America and do that kind of stuff. Because we would never be able to pay for the people's injuries. And that was every night in every city. It was especially with those two guys. And they just... wrestling them was just brilliant. And I got to be great friends with them because you're traveling all the time and you're either on a plane or you're on a ferry and you have an opportunity to kind of get off to the side and talk. And I got to be great friends with both Brody and Hanson. I really appreciated that opportunity to get to be friends with those guys. They were tremendous, tremendous athletes. Fabulous, fabulous workers in the ring, and as stiff as any piece of steel that was ever made.
Ron, you mentioned working with Giant Baba. What was that like? And had you seen those chops? I mean, they've been ridiculed throughout the years by various fans, those somewhat slow chops that he would deliver and then everyone would sell like they were shot. Did you have to do that? And what did you think of that?
I was not really impressed with Baba. Obviously, he's actually probably a legitimately 7 foot plus guy. He was quite a few inches taller than me and at 6'9". That's unusual in itself, but he did not work like I do, you know, and, he's a lot slower, more methodical. He did not, obviously he's not going to drop kick you. And there's a lot of things you don't expect to get from Baba. What you do experience when you're, when you're in another country, especially in one in which you don't speak the language, is you can't talk. And there's no communication in there. And he would grab you and throw you in the ropes, and you come off. You don't know what to expect. I mean, you know, you're like, you don't want to just walk onto the, over to the ropes and then slowly walk back off, and you got your arms across your chest or whatever it would be. You just, you go and hit those ropes and you come off, and you never know what you're going to get. And I found out, that a lot of guys, Saruta as an example, Jumbo was a great worker, and he was very good. You had to be more concerned sometimes with him because he was capable of doing a lot more things than what Baba was capable of doing. Baba was slow and deliberate. I think we had not a very long match, but I appreciated the opportunity to work with a guy of that size and that stature and his reputation. And they, you know, I guess I'm kind of a nut in some ways. Rob would have gone, I'm working with Baba. You know, Rob would have gone, oh, no, no. He would have wanted to change the card. Hey, no, no, don't put me with Baba. You know, but for me, you know, I say, what the heck? You know, I want to see what it's all about and experience all of it. And working with Baba was an experience, as it was with most of the Japanese guys. Mill and Dos, we worked with them twice. There's a trip for you too. I mean, you know, you got the Flyers here, and they're going to do some things that you're not going to see the Japanese do. We got to experience, Barry and I, some really different types of matches that I came home feeling better about what I had experienced and feeling like I was probably a better wrestler than I was when I went there. And I think that's part of the deal for anybody that's really wants to go places and wants to be somebody in the sport. They need to experience all the styles, and they need to experience a lot of countries as well.
Well, there you hear it, a couple of examples of the kind of programming that we put out with the Super Studcast and the rest of the story for patrons of the Studcast. We encourage you, if you enjoy the Studcast, check it out. For only $2.99, you get to access over 3 hours of additional content each and every month, including some of the content you just heard here on this program. Go to tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast to become a patron of the Studcast right now. But until next time, Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. We'll be back with episode 87 next week. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. Tally-ho!
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.